From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world can't even settle on what to call it in headlines, a refugee crisis, a migrant crisis, but we all know from the flood of heartbreaking images, it is a human crisis unfolding right now on the doorstep of Europe. So how should the world, not just Europe, respond? And what about the United States? And how do we address this problem at its source? This hour on Point, out of Syria and beyond, a human crisis and global response. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is it time for the U.S. to throw open its doors? And how do we get to the root of this problem? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from Roger Cohen and Tariq Ramadan on the heart, the root of the problem, but first to the crisis right now. Kathleen Newland is senior fellow and co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute. She joins me from Geneva, Switzerland. Kathleen Newland, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Good to be with you.
Europe pushing very hard today from the top. President Juncker there saying everybody needs to pitch in here and ready to hand out quotas. This may continue to unfold during the day, but do you think this will ultimately fly? Is Europe going to latch on and share the burden?
I think Europe already is sharing the burden. They've had hundreds of thousands of people arriving across the Mediterranean in the last 2 years. And in the last days and sort of week, we have heard Chancellor Merkel of Germany say that Germany would welcome refugees, that they could take as many as 500,000 people a year in the next few years. And I think, you know, you need to put that in perspective. Germany is about one quarter the size of the United States in terms of population. If we were doing the equivalent, we would be taking 2 million refugees a year. So Germany is being extremely generous, and so is Sweden. Several other European countries are pitching in, but Europe is really divided on this subject right now.
Well, we see that, and I take your point. Of course, the refugees are there, and a number of countries have been very open in saying we'll take them in. But Chancellor Merkel also very clear. And the news and issue of this day, Kathleen, as you well know there, is whether or not this burden will be shared among the European nations. And you've got countries resisting. The call from Brussels is for that sharing to be explicit and numerical. Do you see that flying?
I think it's going to be difficult to get agreement from countries like Hungary and Slovakia. It's particularly the Eastern European countries, which don't have a contemporary tradition of migration. They've been more likely to lose people than to attract people until the time of this crisis. And I think it's going to be very difficult to get them to agree. I think really this amounts to a sort of existential threat to European unity.
Can we go to the issue of refugee versus migrant? You see both those words in headlines all over the place, certainly in the United States. How do you characterize? You're at the Migration Institute, but are these refugees? Are they migrants? Are they both?
The flows consist of both, and that is one of the things that makes it so difficult to deal with, is that you have probably the majority of people crossing are indeed refugees. They're coming from places like Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Somalia, where there are active conflicts, where there is rampant persecution, and those people are unquestionably refugees, but you also have people coming from countries that are just very, very poor and people who are looking for a better prospect in life, and they would not conform to our definition of a refugee. So the European states, other states they're crossing through, don't have a legal obligation to allow them to stay. They may want to for other reasons, whether humanitarian or economic, but there's no obligation there as there is to refugees.
So it's complicated.
It is complicated.
In a situation like this where everybody's mixed together and, you know, marching down those railways and into police lines in Hungary and all the rest, is this a time where you throw out the screening process and say, we've got one big mass here, refugees and migrants, and everybody's in trouble, bring them all in?
In the short term, I think that is what is going to happen. But among the measures announced today by the European Commission are measures having to do with the return of migrants, the return of people who are not refugees, both in terms of sort of establishing guidelines for how you return people in a way that's humane and respectful of their human rights, but also recognizes the distinction between obligations toward refugees and obligations toward migrants. The Europeans are also proposing to establish a list of so-called safe countries, countries that are assumed not to generate refugees, which would include most of the Western Balkan states, some stable countries in Africa, and around the world. That's problematic. You know, it's many of the countries that have in the past been declared so-called safe countries or countries in which, just to give an example, it's still illegal to be gay. You know, so there is persecution in, for example, some of the Western Balkan countries against Roma, against transgendered people, against people of certain religious persuasion. So it's very hard to say prima facie this country doesn't produce refugees. It's much easier to say that some countries definitely do produce refugees, and there really isn't a screening process for people from Syria these days, and there really doesn't need to be because someone is trying to persecute almost everyone in Syria.
I mean, the war there has been terrible. Millions and millions displaced. A substantial portion of those, 4.1 million, outside the country. Neighboring countries with huge burdens here. In Lebanon, one in every four people is now a Syrian refugee. The numbers in Europe look small by comparison to that, and yet they're large. And now people are talking about other countries that ought to be stepping up here. They're looking at the Gulf states and saying, hey, why not you? And they're looking at the United States. What do you think the United States should be doing here, Kathleen?
Well, I think we should increase our refugee resettlement program and streamline it so that we can accept more Syrian refugees in a timely fashion. Our resettlement program for refugees is a very cumbersome, very bureaucratic, very slow process. It's not set up for emergency response. And I think looking at the situation in and around Syria, this is a genuine, acute humanitarian emergency. It can't be met just with money. We need to be able to help those the countries that are offering first asylum by offloading some of the refugees and allowing them to start a new life in the United States.
This was David Miliband here, who former foreign secretary in Britain, now head of the International Rescue Committee, talking with ABC's This Week on Sunday.
The U.S. has always been a leader in refugee resettlement, but 1,500 people over 4 years is such a minuscule contribution to tackling the human side of this problem that people are rightly, in my view, sponsoring a legislation in the United States Senate for that number to be anything like the 65,000 by the end of 2016 that would represent the kind of leadership that America has traditionally shown on these kind of issues.
There's a number thrown out. Some have picked it up already in political circles. 65,000 refugees to be accepted by the United States as a proposal. John Kerry talking on Capitol Hill about all this today. What do you think of that number? Is that high? Is that low? Is it what the U.S. should do? Are we waiting on somebody else to move first?
It's the number is 65,000, and I believe it's 65,000 over 2 years because UNHCR was calling for 130,000 Syrians to be resettled over 2 years. And it's perfectly reasonable for the U.S. to take half that number. We're a huge country with a dynamic economy, with lots of space, and with an venerable and honorable tradition of accepting refugees. I entirely agree with David that it's a matter of U.S. leadership, the kind of leadership that has made us the country we are. I also think we have some responsibility here, and a third and very much sort of down the list of reasons to do this is that we have benefited from accepting refugees. If you look back at the German scientists who helped us win World War II, the Hungarians like Andy Grove, who founded Intel, the Russians, who Sergey Brin, who founded Google, the Vietnamese and the Chinese valedictorians who now populate our high-tech industries. this is a country that has done well by doing good, and we should be thinking about this in a long-term perspective.
Hillary Clinton says we should do our part. Martin O'Malley says 65,000, not too big a number for this country. John Kasich, Republican candidate, saying we've got a responsibility to take more people in. But Carly Fiorina says, watch out, there could be terrorists among them. We can't do this. What do you say to that, Kathleen?
I think that is it verges on paranoid, really, because the way people come in through our refugee resettlement program is very different from what the Europeans are facing at the moment. The Europeans have flows of people who are coming in spontaneously. Europeans have had no opportunity to screen them or select them in any manner. That's not how our refugee program works.
Even in this circumstance, would we be taking them from these crisis camps in Hungary or going through some methodical, slow process out of Lebanon, Turkey?
In my view, we should be taking them from the region around Syria. The Europeans can take responsibility for the numbers that they're getting quite easily in practical terms. They are obviously having difficulty in political terms. But we have in the past used emergency procedures. In 1999, for example, we decided to resettle 20,000 people from Kosovo on very short notice. We flew them to disused military bases, to Fort Dix in New Jersey. We even flew some to Guam, where they could be processed and screened properly in a way that was safe for them and safe for us. And there's no reason why we couldn't come up with that kind of an arrangement today.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about who should help take the refugees, migrants, pouring out of Syria and beyond, looking at the U.S. role and how to address the problem at its source, this crisis we have all seen explode in Europe. Kathleen Newland is with us from the Migration Policy Institute in Geneva, Switzerland. Here, last week in migrants, all those in Hungary, all those migrants trapped in Budapest, and we saw and heard so many terrible images there and beyond, evacuated from the train station. The refugees began to protest outside, hoping to make it to the border. Here's just one.
Please make us our solution. Please find for us a solution. I have no more appetite to speak. I think words cannot be reached. How to reach our words? How is the way?
Words are not enough. Before Parliament yesterday, British Prime Minister David Cameron said the British people now want to help those affected by the crisis.
The whole country has been deeply moved by the heartbreaking images we've seen over the past few days. And it is absolutely right that Britain should fulfil its moral responsibility to help those refugees, just as we've done so proudly throughout our history.
The Pope weighed in Sunday at the Vatican.
Rivolgo un appello alle parrocchie.
In Italian here, appealing, he said, to the parishes, the religious communities, monasteries, sanctuaries all over Europe to show the true meaning of the gospel and take in one family each, of refugees, their Pope Francis. That appeal may go beyond Europe. Kathleen Newland is with us from Geneva, Switzerland. With us right now from Great Falls, Virginia, Asra Nomani, Indian-American journalist and Muslim author. Her recent op-ed in the Daily Beast was headlined, "The Middle East Needs to Take Care of Its Own Refugees." Asra Nomani, thank you for joining us. That sounds heartless on its face. What are you saying?
No, I'm an immigrant to this country and have great compassion. And what I do notice in the conversation that we're having is this hashtag that I saw in the early days, which was hashtag begging the question, because what we are not hearing are the voices of the Gulf country leaders. You know, Kathleen was talking about
Saudi Arabia, Qatar, beyond.
Right. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Oman, Bahrain. Kathleen talked about, the United States, a huge country with a lot of space and a lot of money. That describes Saudi Arabia. It's almost as big as all of Western Europe. It's got a GDP bigger than Switzerland.
Yeah, but come on. I mean, so much of it is just blank desert. Please.
You know, at the end of the day, what we hear is excuses. I mean, that's the problem. There's one of the authors and writers that I've quoted who's said, you know, it's a racism of lowered expectations. Why don't we hold wealthy brown people to the same standards of conscience as wealthy white people?
Is it really excuses? I mean, after all, most of the refugees coming out of Syria are surely Shia, as Saudi Arabia is famously Sunni. Do they even want to go there?
You know, and why do we accept these kind of, sort of barriers that also
because they're killing each other. ISIS is Sunni, and they're wailing on a lot of Syrians right now.
So what we end up doing is we say Saudi Arabia has created much of this problem, and thus we let Saudi Arabia off the hook. And this is the cycle that we always end up in. And so then we have this narrative of let's blame the West, and the West has to fix all of these problems. But at the end of the day, the neighborhood doesn't take care of its own problems. And I can tell you that, you know, one of the images that really struck me was this image of the young island Kurdi's body in front of a tombstone that was marked Arab conscience, because that is what's really at stake. We talk about the morality of the U.S., of England, of all of these countries in Europe, and yet why don't we talk about the conscience of the Arab world? And
Asra, stand by. Kathleen Newland, a lot of neighbors, Muslim countries, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, are doing a lot, and we should emphasize that. I mean, a lot. It's not perfect, and the UN has not got the resources to support refugees there very well right now. But one in four people in Lebanon is a refugee from Syria. But you hear Asra Nomani saying the wider neighborhood should take care of its own problem. What's your response to that, Kevin?
Well, I agree that the Gulf states could do more. I don't really see them taking in a great many Syrian refugees. And the reason is that most of them, Saudi Arabia being an exception, most of them have very small populations. Saudi Arabia has 31 million people, so less than a tenth the size of the U.S. As you pointed out, Tom, most of its land is unproductive and, can't be farmed or grazed upon.
But still, they're rich. They could do something bigger here.
They could give more. 33%, a third of their population already is composed of foreigners.
But those are, as you know, are hired temporary workers who get sent back home. And among them, Syrians, we should point out.
So and I was about to say, many, many Syrians live in Saudi Arabia. They would prefer to go there to work. They would prefer to, wherever they are, to be working and able to support themselves. And there are many Syrians working in Saudi Arabia and in other Gulf countries. I'm not excusing them for not doing more. I believe they should be doing more. But I particularly think they should be giving more money for humanitarian relief. And above all, they should be trying to influence their clients in the conflict to bring this conflict to an end. That's the greatest contribution they could make to the Syrian refugee crisis, and that's what we should be expecting of them.
Let me get our listeners in, if I may. Brian in Austin, Texas. You're on the air, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, obviously the humanitarian crisis going on is not lost on our compassionate side, but the United States has been dealing with a refugee and immigrant crisis for years that, frankly, it could arguably dwarf what Europe is facing with the North African immigrants.
Which and one, Brian?
But it's not like Europe has leapt forward to assist the United States with our wave of immigrants who are staking a claim to refugee status.
You're talking about from Central America, South America?
Yes, that's correct.
Let us pick that up. Kathleen Newland, the U.S. should come to Europe's aid now. Did Europe come to America's aid when we had so many people flooding in, children among them, just last summer from Central America?
Well, I'm not suggesting that the United States should come to Europe's aid, except perhaps with advice, because we have a much better experience of integrating refugees and migrants in the United States than most European countries do. But the numbers are really not comparable. In the thick of the unaccompanied minors crisis, we had about 67,000 children who came across the southern border, perhaps about that many again, families coming across. So say we had 140,000. Europe has had 320,000 so far this year and are expecting that number to grow substantially by the end of the year. I would not have expected Europeans to come to our assistance, although they did in the aftermath of the Vietnam War when we were trying to resettle the hundreds of thousands of boat people who were stuck, having fled Vietnam. Many of them did settle in France, in Britain, in Australia, and in Canada. So I think we should regard this crisis, as we regarded that crisis, as a global crisis, not just a Middle Eastern or a European crisis, and I think we should be part of the solution.
Let's go to Terry in Fort Dodge, Iowa. Terry, you're on the air with Asra Nomani and Kathleen Newland.
Yes, hi, Tom. Great show. I'm a conservative who grew up in Africa, 57 years old, mm-hmm. and I am really stunned and appalled. I was appalled when my fellow conservative invaded Iraq, but I read an article yesterday by Pat Buchanan. He used the that was referenced on Yahoo. He used the expression "pull up the drawbridge." He was talking about the problem of Europe will have to pull up the drawbridge because there's so many that will follow these guys. I also want to reference the that there's a British dystopian movie called The Children of Men, and it was so appalling because in there they had migrants put in cages in England, and I think we're seeing. I mean, it's a frightening scenario. But I think, of course, this is a little bit of a change of direction in the conversation, but John McCain called Obama's, for the last 4 years since the Syrian thing erupted, they've been saying if you don't deal with this, it's going to cause massive chaos, and that's what we're looking at now. And so I'm really worried that virtually no one yet, and I listen to NPR every day, is talking about the problem of ISIS.
We'll look at ISIS. We're going to go in just a moment to Roger Cohen and Tariq Ramadan. Look at this problem at its source. But I want to put this to Kathleen at Azra. It's not just Pat Buchanan, Kathleen. I mean, Tom Friedman is writing in the New York Times today that the world of disorder is now spilling over into the world of order. And he says that's going to go on and on, driven by climate change and technology and globalization. What about our caller's fear that there's no end to this? And kind of sense, and Pat Buchanan says there's no end, therefore pull up the drawbridge.
Well, I think that's an irresponsible attitude and a very alarmist one. These things tend to go in waves. I think even though there is no end in sight to the Syrian war, it will end. The wave of people trying to leave that region, many people will be eager to return to their homes, even though it may take years for them to be able to do so. So it's, to think of to have this sort of nightmare of unending streams of people sort of knocking at the door, it's certainly ahistorical, and I don't think it is realistic either. But our caller did have a very good point in pointing to the missed opportunities to try to intervene in Syria earlier on. I don't necessarily mean intervene militarily, but really put pressure on our allies to put pressure on their clients not exacerbate this.
We'll look at that. Asra Nomani, you're pretty hard-nosed here. I mean, you're an immigrant yourself, but now here are migrants, refugees, sitting out in the elements. Winter is coming, as Juncker said today. You'd leave them there until Saudi Arabia takes them?
Here's the thing, Tom. What I'm talking about is having some kind of balance in terms of refugee policy. But refugee policy is foreign policy. And as long as we have a policy in which we don't put responsibility on neighbor nations,
their neighbors have taken millions. Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey.
What I hear, even in your response, mm-hmm. are excuses for Gulf countries that are not doing what they should be doing. And mm-hmm. Kathleen will even admit this. And when we talk about how people are alarmist, I mean, Kathleen's even written that any failure in improper integration can mean a major deterioration in our security as well as a threat to values. These aren't issues that are just alarmist and xenophobic. I mean, really, these are serious issues that Greece is dealing with in other countries. And we already know that even legal immigration has created great challenges in our Muslim communities on issues of communities that also end up becoming intolerant or individuals who end up becoming militant. And these are serious things that, we can't just have our eyes glaze over. And so, yes, we have to have compassion and we have to have responsibility, but it needs to be measured also to include all of the nations of the world and not just look westward.
Asra Nomani, her piece in the Daily Beast is "The Middle East Needs to Take Care of Its Own Refugees." Asra, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Kathleen Newland in Geneva, Switzerland, at the Migration Policy Institute. Kathleen, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Here's Mohammed Daha, Syrian refugees, talking with the Associated Press yesterday, explaining why he and others are leaving for other countries.
The people, they are moving from country to another country, from Asia to Europe, to get rest there. Okay, to be on the peace. What they are looking for peace. Because you cannot live without peace.
You cannot live without peace. How do we address this problem, this crisis, at its source? To help us look at that right now from New York, or is Roger Cohen, columnist for the New York Times, has covered Europe, been in Europe a lot, back in the U.S. now. Roger Cohen, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Mantova, Italy, Tariq Ramadan joins us, professor of contemporary Islamic studies at Oxford University, author of Islam and the Arab Awakening. Tariq Ramadan, welcome back to On Point to you, sir.
Hello, Tom.
Roger, we're talking a lot about who should take what in terms of refugee and migrant flow right now. Europe struggling with that. The U.S. Looking at that very, very pointedly today. What about going to the source of this? How do we, you heard the refugee right there saying you can't live without peace. Without peace, people keep coming, people keep suffering. How do we get to the heart of the problem at home in Syria and beyond, Roger?
Well, I think people are reluctant to go to the source because the source is so daunting and so, frankly, depressing. There's no question, I think, that when people look back on the Obama presidency, Syria will be a major blot on his record. There's no point rehearsing the whole saga now, but clearly over 4 years, Syria has been allowed to disintegrate. There are 4 million Syrians out of the country. There are 11 million displaced. There are untold numbers of dead. And yes, human nature, as that refugee so poignantly put it, human nature seeks stability, seeks peace, seeks being able to know that you can take your kids to school the next day without the school being blown up. So as long as the situation in Iraq remains as unstable as it is, and in Syria, and with ISIS sweeping across both those countries, I think the flow is going to continue. Kathleen said the Syrian war will end one day. Well, we'll all end one day, but I don't see any sign of it in the near future. That said, we should be doing clearly a lot more in the region. I mean, all these camps in Turkey, in Lebanon, in Jordan are underfunded. There's not enough food. There is no process. There's chaos right now. So that needs to be addressed in some form.
Tariq Ramadan, if the flow is unending, if it's understood as unending because the problem cannot be effectively addressed at its source, we may see willingness to take this flow ebb. You know, unending sounds overwhelming. So how do we get at the problem at the source, Tariq? Daunting as it is.
No, I think that, as it was said, it's very difficult, but we can't just stop history and stop talking now without taking into account what happened over the last, let's say, at least 15 years. In 2003, we heard George W. Bush saying that we want democracy in the region, and all the things happened in Iraq, and this is what we had. The Iraqi pattern is the starting point of a destabilized Middle East, and then we had Libya and what is happening in Africa. At the end of the day, it's good to speak about democracy, but the Western countries, the United States and the European countries, as well as Russia and China, they should now take also responsibility to come to find solution in the region, because the people, what they want is dignity and justice and democracy, and this is with this they will stay. If not, they are going to come. And there are two issues here. The first one is about the immediate things that we have to address, and this has to do with human rights. And we are talking here about refugees. We are not talking about migrants. We are talking about refugees, and they have rights, and we have to protect their life and to welcome them. But at the same time, we all have, all the citizens, we should not react emotionally to what is happening. We should react as citizens and asking our respective governments to do something about the reasons and the causes and why, for example, I have been cynical about what was happening over the last few years.
Tariq Ramadan, hold the thought there if you'd be good enough there in Italy. We will come back to that. Tariq Ramadan joins us. Roger Cohen is with us. We're looking at who should do what for the refugees, migrants. Even our migration expert says there's both there now, but certainly refugees. And how do we get to the source, the root of this problem? This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about who should help take the refugees, and among them migrants, pouring out of Syria and well beyond right now, looking at the U.S. role and how to address this problem at its source, with New York Times columnist Roger Cohen. Knows the region very well, Europe and the Middle East. Tariq Ramadan, same, joins us from Mantova, Italy, professor of Islamic studies at Oxford University. Of course, the need is urgent. It's immediate. State of the Union speech in Strasbourg, France yesterday. The EC, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, called on the European Union to step up.
We are not talking about 40,000. We are not talking about 120,000. It's 160,000. That's the number Europeans have to take in charge and have to take in their arms. And I really hope that this time everyone will be on board. No poems, no rhetorics. Action is what is needed for the time being.
No poems, no rhetoric. Action is what is needed. Roger Cohen, Tariq Ramadan, I'll bring it to you. A few calls from our many listeners on this. Joan in Malden, Massachusetts. Joan, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I think the only way to cure this is action, and I think we have to look at refugees or whatever you want to call them. They're people that need help now, and we should all be happy to say, come in, welcome. These are people that, through no fault of their own, are in the middle of the ocean trying to save their families. And I can't imagine, every single one of those people are important, more important than flying a missile out of space or whatever we're spending.
How many would you invite into the United States, Joan? How many?
Oh, we could take in a lot. If Germany can take in what they're taking, and my hat goes off to her, she's fabulous, we should be able to triple that.
Joan, we hear it. Very direct, loud and clear. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Fadi in Austin, Texas. Fadi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So I want to address your first question. Who should help? I think three areas. We can talk Arab Gulf countries, Jordan, and United Europe and United States.
Okay, my note here says that you are Jordanian in origin, Fadi. Is that right?
Originally from Jordan.
Okay.
So Jordan is a 6 million population. We have 1 million Syrian refugees. So we have around 20% of the population now refugees from Syria. And we get like another 20% from Iraq and other Arab countries. So Jordan does a lot, but the problem, Jordan has no energy and water resources. So Europe and United States and Arab Gulf countries should immediately help Jordan to take care of these refugees. This is number one. Number two, Saudi Arabia has feeded the conflict in Syria with more people than they received refugees. So people left, like Saudi Arabia guys left Saudi Arabia to the war in Syria,
yeah,
more than they hosted people as, yeah, refugees.
Yeah.
Now, for Europe and the United States, I think they're doing good, but looking at the percentage Jordan and Lebanon hosting, I think they can do more. Not 1,000, not 10,000, hundreds of thousands.
How do we solve this at the source, Fadi? That's the question we're putting to Tariq Ramadan and Roger Cohen. How do we solve this on the ground there so the people don't want to leave?
I don't want to be pessimistic. I'm afraid now, 4 years after the conflict, this conflict should have been solved and treated like at year number one or two. Now we are like 4 years with this conflict, things going out of control. I'm afraid the situation in Syria will be similar to Iraq, where there is no hope in the coming 10 years or 20 years. I think we should support people and in Syria. We should we should try to isolate the militants like ISIS and other groups, and just work with people from all religion sources. Syria has Christian and Muslim, Shi'i and Sunni. They have been living together with peace, in peace for a long time. So what prevents us from making that peace coming back?
That's one central question here, Fadi. I'm very grateful for your call. Roger Cohen, 10 to 20 years of no hope, that's a long time and potentially an awful lot of desperate people looking for somewhere else to go. You're critical of the Obama administration's handling of the Syria crisis. Here we are. It's 2015. Tariq says we have to look back, and that's fine, but we have to look at right now and ahead, too. What do we do?
Well, first of all, I agree with the first caller. I mean, everybody's is called into play here, and you can't see images like the boy Elam dead on the beach or 71 migrants, refugees dead in the back of a truck, a kind of modern-day boxcar, without your heart going out to them. And there has to be an immense effort, perhaps beyond what even what Jean-Claude Juncker described today, to try and address this problem. It's a moment of absolute crisis. You know, what's happened in the region, I think a lot of people obviously fled Syria, but their initial thought was to go back, and they've been camped around Syria awaiting a possible return. Well, after 4 years, hope has expired, and so they are moving to safety, they are moving to stability, and it doesn't matter how many are drowning. It doesn't matter how much they have to pay. When it's life or death, you take desperate measures. And I think that is what we are seeing today. I think Tariq made a good point. We can't stop trying diplomatically in Syria, and that requires the major powers, as with the Iran deal, to come together. That requires Russia and China and the European Union and the United States to be at the table, just as they showed they were capable of doing in reaching the Iran nuclear accord, which I think is a very good thing, not perfect, but good. And we have to see the same kind of diplomatic effort in Syria. That has been very, very elusive. But that's not a reason for giving up trying. Tariq said another thing which I didn't agree with entirely, and that was, well, look, President George W. Bush talked about democracy and freedom, and then look what's happened. And he said the people in the region, if I understood correctly, want that. I think most of them do. But if you look at Egypt, where you had a brief experiment with freedom and democracy, which resulted in the Muslim Brotherhood getting elected, and that experiment was immediately aborted with the support of a lot of Egyptians. And I think what you've seen since 2010, 2011, is that there is no consensus across this region about what form of government is needed or what institutions can mediate the differences between Sunni and Shia and Christians and others in order to form stable government. And in the absence of that consensus, what you have had is vacuum. And nothing likes a vacuum, nobody likes a vacuum like a jihadi. And that is what you are seeing, of course, in Syria with the emergence of Islamic State and its ability, more or less unchecked, to move across the region. That, in turn, is creating a lot of anguish and anxiety that continues to feed this problem.
Roger, I appreciate that. Tariq Ramadan, how do we get out of that knot? How do we escape it? You say people want democracy and dignity. George Bush called for democracy. He may have been deluded in the way he wanted to bring it, but he called for it. People clearly want peace and stability. How do we move in that direction? What's the change required, Tariq?
I think it's quite important, and what John was saying now, it's very important. I think that we can't doubt the fact that the people, they want dignity and justice. This is why they took into the street in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, and even in Syria, and in Yemen. These are things that are clear, and these are hopes that they have. The problem.
But the aftermath has been hellacious.
That's true. But at the end, what we need to understand is that there are shared responsibilities. What we are talking about what the West should do with Russia and China involved in the region. But at the same time, what is really true and very needed now, it's coming from within. What we need now is intellectuals and politicians and the civil society in the Middle East to be much more involved in the process. And we also have to call into account the Gulf states, because they are nurturing an ideology that is in fact upstream from all what we have with the people who are ending up being violent and ISIS and Daesh, and these people are coming from a literally background that is also promoted by the Gulf states. So we have to call the Muslims, and we have to call the citizens and to call the intellectuals there, not only to blame the West, but to look, for example, the divide that we have now between Sunni and Shia, it is not only coming from the state, it's not coming from the West nurturing division, it's coming from within. So if we are not able to look at this and to find common ground and to at least agree on some essential principles coming from there in the Arab countries and the Muslim majority countries, we're not going to make it. So we cannot just blame the other. It has to also, we need to have dynamic actions from within, and to also ask the governments over there to look at their own responsibility.
Yep. Troy in Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yes. Isn't this blowback from Obama trying to break the Syrian government? And what, you know, keep in mind, Saudi Arabia is the richest country in the world. I mean, they can afford to spend money and make camps. And if they can't make the camps, maybe they could put some of those camps in the place where the person who made this problem. Maybe they should use that White House fence and put the camp right there, right at the White House fence where Obama made this problem.
Troy, we'll talk about blowback here. I mean, there's all kinds of blowback, but I understand the focus on the Saudis. They certainly have a lot of resources. Let me get one more right here, if I may. Bill in Beloit, Wisconsin. Bill, you're on.
Thanks for the opportunity, Tom. Mm-hmm. I think that all the resources that we have spent, as the United States has spent, to cause this trouble with the $1 trillion-plus in Iraq, with the $1 billion to overthrow Gaddafi, with all the money that we have spent in the last 4.5 years to overthrow Assad, as the client state of Israel, basically the United States, should use the resources to create peace, to try and stop all the warfare and resettle the Syrians, and also take in a huge amount of them and spend money on the camps.
Client state, we got a lot of client. I don't know about that, but what about Saudi Arabia? Troy says, let them pay. They're rich.
Well, they also are in league with the U.S. and Israel, and yes, they should too.
Bill, we got it. One more. Anna, Summertown, Tennessee. Anna, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Well, I would like to suggest that we go to some of the people who are making armaments and, you know, profiting millions, billions of dollars, and asking them to help us finance aid to all these people who are suffering and who are, you know, have become refugees.
If you sold arms to the Middle East, help pay for the problems now. Certainly a lot has been sold, and I appreciate your call. Roger Cowan, can we go to blowback? Do you see what's unfolding here is blowback from this administration, that administration, this Saudi, this Middle Eastern government, that Middle Eastern government? Who, it's it gets to fault, I guess, responsibility.
No, I don't. I think there's been a lot of American mistakes, beginning with the Iraq invasion in the area. But I don't think we can say that President Obama has been, there's been blowback from his trying to break the government of Assad. Right now, the president is trying to break ISIS, which is an opponent, if you like, would like to overthrow Assad. The trouble with American policy is it's been completely incoherent. I certainly don't absolve, as I said at the beginning, the president of blame in the Syrian crisis. I think it's been one of his worst moments to have said early in the conflict that President Assad will go without having any notion of how to attain that objective. was an error and very irresponsible, I think, of a U.S. president to say such a thing. And then to set a red line on use of chemical weapons, send out the Secretary of State to make an eloquent speech explaining why military action would be taken, and then at the last minute, with the French ready to go, pull back, that sent all kinds of bad messages and has, in my view, just exacerbated the problem. So I think there's been blowback from incoherence and inaction, but not from an attempt to break the Assad government. There's been really no coherent attempt that I can see to do that. As for the Saudis, well, in theory, yeah, but there's also the people. You know, where do they want to go? I don't see people, you know, banging on the door of Saudi Arabia saying, let me in, let me in. Mm-hmm. I mean, people in the age we live in, which is borderless online but has borders in the physical world, people have access to images from everywhere, even if they live in great poverty. And people know what life, they have a notion of what life is like in Europe, and that is where they want to go. They don't really want, I think, to go to Saudi Arabia. Yes, the Saudis should step up with money and should declare a readiness to take some of the people in flight, but I don't think you're going to see the kinds of scenes we've seen in Europe there, for the simple reason that there's not a desire, there's not really a desire to go there. People want to go to places where they think they can have a stable life. And I think when countries like Sweden and Germany prove so welcoming, it would be nice to see a recognition of that from refugees and migrants. I read a piece on the front page of my own newspaper about a migrant in Sweden whining about conditions there. Well, please, you know, I mean, it might not be a paradise, but it's Sweden, for God's sake.
Roger Cohen, we're up against the clock here. I'm so grateful to you for joining us today. Thank you very much, Roger, for being here.
Pleasure, Tom.
And Tariq Ramadan, there's much more to be said. I hope we can carve out some time and do that. Thank you for joining us, Tariq.
Thank you.
Trouble aplenty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.